We're now at this slightly odd position of everybody agrees that the vulnerabilities equities process is broken. You know, we have people from the EFF saying it is broken. We have people from the intelligence community saying it is broken. We now have a rare opportunity, now that everybody agrees that it is broken, to actually collect the data on it and then just say, well, you know, one of these sides has to be right. So we can get, you know, the intelligence community can provide data, possibly in classified form, to say this is the number of zero-day collisions that have actually occurred over, you know, 10 years of collecting data. And in the event that the answer is, you know, most of our zero days are colliding with foreign adversaries, then, you know, the EFF clearly wins. And in the event that the answer is none of our zero days have ever collided, then actually the intelligence community wins. And we need to recognize that, you know, this isn't necessarily the best way of doing defense.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 27th, 2016. That was Matt Tate, the CEO of Capital Alpha Security. Matt came on the podcast with Dave Etal, the CEO of Immunity, Inc., to talk about their recent Lawfare essay critiquing the current status of the vulnerability equities process. Matt and Dave argued that the process by which the U.S. government decides whether or not to disclose software vulnerabilities is fundamentally broken. It's an issue that has come to the forefront once again with the recent leak of NSA information by the Shadow Brokers Group, which included a number of exploits, some of which were zero days that the agency apparently decided against disclosing. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 185, Dave Etal and Matt Tate on how everything you know about the vulnerability equities process is wrong.
So I want to start by having both of you describe what your background in this specific set of issues is. Most people who talk about zero days have never actually worked with one, particularly not in an offensive sense. And so I'm interested to hear from both of you, like, what's your experience with the issues that the vulnerabilities equities process confronts on a day-to-day basis?
All right, so my experience starts off, I started off working at GCHQ in their offensive exploitation team, building zero-day vulnerabilities and helping to engineer them so that they were production ready. I then moved into consulting, where I was helping technology companies primarily discover zero-day vulnerabilities in software that they had built, and helping them to design systems that were inherently more resistant to exploitation. And then I worked for Google's Project Zero, helping to discover zero-day vulnerabilities in important software like Microsoft Windows and so on, and helping to disclose those vulnerabilities and to make software more secure in that regard.
So it's fair to say that you've worked on both the offensive and defensive side of this?
Very much so. So I've worked building zero days and trying to find zero day collisions, and also trying to defend against zero days as a category as well.
And you, Dave?
Well, a little bit like Matt, I started my career in government. I was a computer scientist at the National Security Agency as a young, crazy kid. I ended up working for At Stake shortly thereafter, which is it's an old company, but now it's Symantec. And they did a lot of security consulting, especially in the financial sector. I was based in New York. Then started Immunity, which is a boutique security consultancy and product provider. We sell Canvas and Silica and a bunch of other products in the, you know, exploitation space. We also had our own debugger specifically for exploit development called Immunity Debugger, which was very popular since it was free. It was ad-supported. And I've actually done quite a lot of research myself. I can't say that I've written an O-Day in the past year, but you know, when you run a good security consultancy, you read O-Day after O-Day after O-Day after O-Day. That's what you do as the job. And for me, it's been largely with large financial companies or large manufacturing companies. But nonetheless, I'm probably one of the more technical CEOs that we have in this industry. Been trying to stay up to date on modern exploitation techniques. I used to have this thing that I would do whenever anyone was like, how do I understand this policy stuff? And I would say, go to the very first bug track message and then read it for 5 years. And then you'll have a picture of where we came from. You know, I manage a mailing list called Daily Dave, which actually is poorly titled, but full of all of this, all the CEOs, all of the major technical people in the offensive space. And we post various comments on exploits, on policy, on all these things. But we very much are all tied to the technical reality instead of being, for example, professors who have law degrees, who you see a lot of in this area. You see a lot of people who do policy who have never used a debugger, who can't write a C program. So I think that's where Matt and I stand out here. We're both willing to talk about it. I mean, Matt's better at the policy than I am, but, you know, I've studied a little bit of it as well. And then we come from that technical background where you just, if you haven't managed an O-Day, had it patched, seen that the patch didn't work, rewritten that O-Day, and tried to communicate to the vendor in a way that is positive that they messed up and we need it fixed because we have, you know, a giant financial customer written, you know, this, the level of process around this issue is so complex. The idea that you can find a new bug class, not even a new vulnerability, but a whole new bug class, and then be able to exploit that bug class for 10, 15 years, is, I think, just these concepts are just not out there in the policy space yet. So hopefully people read our paper, and I know parts of it were controversial, which is why I post my personal cell phone to Twitter so people can call me and yell at me. But I think we're actually both right. So that's where I come at it from.
So I want to talk about the article that you guys wrote about the vulnerabilities equities process and its less than stellar performance. Let's start, if we can, with sort of with a bit of an overview of how we got to this point and how we ended up talking about these issues. Do you want to sort of, Dave, do you want to bring us up to speed?
Okay. Well, here's how we got here. And I think there's an even bigger strategic issue with regards to the VEP, which is how we create cyber policy in general. But before we get to that, vulnerability equities process, you saw Michael Daniels post a blog about how we are going to lean towards disclosure. But in general, the idea is that vulnerabilities that the NSA or other parts of government, since it's now going to be everybody in government, uses somehow puts the rest of America at risk. And some of those feelings are legitimate and seemingly obviously, if we released all of our vulnerabilities, then theoretically the world would be a safer place. I can just see this recording working real well now that like my cell phone has decided to blow up. But to make things simple, releasing vulnerabilities by the NSA does not make us safer. And what we have instead is a system that is as real as one of any oil company's many ads in, you know, a newspaper that show them cleaning off a duck after an oil spill, showing how amazing they are at cleaning off ducks and protecting everyone from oil spills, when in reality they shouldn't play slaloms with the icebergs out there. And I think that's the problem, is that what we've done is a PR move entirely. It has no strategic relevance, and people want to double down on it. And that's why I think we started writing this article.
All right, so let's break that down into its 1,500 component pieces. Let's start with Matt. Walk us through the vulnerabilities equities process. What is it designed to do, and how, to the extent that it does it, how does it do it?
Okay, so basically the premise of the vulnerabilities equities process is that zero-day vulnerabilities, which are vulnerabilities that, so far as we are aware, nobody else has discovered yet, and which might allow someone to be able to hack a device, and which the targets would not be able to defend themselves against with antivirus software or by patching, that these vulnerabilities can, by definition, be used against our targets, but also by other nations against us. So the vulnerabilities equities process basically asks the question, should we be disclosing these bugs to vendors so that other people can't attack us and our devices, or should we be using them for our own intelligence and military purposes against our targets? And so the vulnerabilities equities process basically tries to establish some kind of in-between, where they say that, you know, some zero-day vulnerabilities obviously have, you know, very important intelligence and military purposes that we need to be able to be deploying these for our purposes. But in the event that we don't need that particular vulnerability for some particular reason, or in the event that that vulnerability is too dangerous, or if we're not able to engineer it into something that we can use, then we should be sort of erring towards disclosing it, in order to say, if we're not going to use it, someone else should be shouldn't be able to be using it against us. And so the vulnerabilities equities process has this essentially a group of individuals from different departments come together, and they discuss between themselves, you know, should this particular vulnerability be used for intelligence, or should it be disclosed to vendors?
So it seems to me that something like the vulnerabilities equities process is inevitable, given that the United States has both offensive interest in zero days and defensive interest in zero days. Yet you guys in this article come down very hard on the current process. So Dave, if you can just walk us through, other than, you know, washing oil off of ducks, what's the problem with the current vulnerabilities equities process, and how what could you imagine being the mechanism instead of it?
Okay, and that's a good question. Like, what is the actual problem? And I'm gonna start this off by saying that, like many of us in the community, I've been dealing with vulnerabilities for 20 years now. But anyone who's been dealing with vulnerabilities knows that they cluster, and our vulnerabilities are not the same vulnerabilities that we can assume that our adversaries have. So that's the very first strategic understanding.
And why is that?
And that's a good question. I think the reality is we don't know why that is. No one's really studied any of this stuff in any depth. It's very difficult to study. It's not just about getting the data. It's also about doing a lot of very detailed analysis that's very technical. For example, people think that disclosing vulnerabilities actually solves the problem, which I find really funny, because anyone who's done pen testing and released vulnerabilities knows that when you tell a customer about a vulnerability, it's 50-50 if they can figure out how to fix it or not, right? Like, unless the government is going to take complete control of the security of our infrastructure programs, like Windows, for example, we can't say that releasing the vulnerabilities fixes anything. And so that's some of these things that you know implicitly from being in the business of vulnerabilities forever. Are things that seem to have gotten ignored in the process. You know, it's obviously farcical, because the amount of manpower required to look at this number of vulnerabilities would be immense. And it's not just the number of vulnerabilities, it's also all the operational security sort of issues surrounding your sources and methods when you release a vulnerability to other people, the attribution levels. Those are like, once you start digging into the process and how it could in theory work, you very quickly realize that you've dug yourself a big
hole. So problem number one is that the categories of vulnerability that that affect the United States are different from the categories of vulnerabilities that we're trying to exploit. What else?
Well, I think that's one part. And then the other part is, even if we gave up all of our vulnerabilities and we used all of our own systems the same exact way Chinese used all of our systems. So let's say everyone uses Windows and we all use Windows 10. Even if we gave up all of our Windows 10 vulnerabilities, we still would not impact significantly China's ability to exploit Windows 10 because we have completely different files. And that's a basic fact of life that everyone in the business
knows. I'm
sorry,
you said because we have completely different...
sort of piles of vulnerabilities. We have different maths. We know different things. We've just focused in different areas. So if your goal is to prevent ransomware from happening, or if your goal is to prevent China from hacking into our systems, then disclosing vulnerabilities does not achieve that or come close to achieving that. And so if you know for a fact the process cannot increase your safety because of basic things that we've all been in the industry understand, then you have to wonder what else this process is for.
All right, so Matt, help me with this. So we have, according to Dave, a mismatch between the process that we've set up and the vulnerabilities we A, want to exploit, and B, experience. First of all, do you agree with that? And secondly, what's the alternative in your view?
Okay, so I mostly agree with Dave on that. I think that zero-day vulnerabilities get an awful lot of press for the amount of damage that they actually cause to U.S. companies. When I've looked at breaches at large numbers of U.S. companies, when I've looked at large quantities of their code, the overwhelming impact that I've seen from zero-day vulnerabilities being used to exploit U.S. companies is that they're by far the minority of actual attacks. That a very large number of real-world attacks against people in the West, as all of these ransomware attacks for sure, are not using zero-day vulnerabilities. They're using things like word macros. They're using things like executable file centers attachments. They're doing things like phishing for users' passwords in order to gain access to people's accounts. So zero-day vulnerabilities, they do have an impact, and foreign adversaries are certainly using them, but they're not, the primary mechanism by which we are being attacked, and that's something that we do need to recognize. And I think the second thing that's very important to recognize is that from a defensive perspective, zero-day vulnerabilities and vulnerabilities in general is usually not the part of the process that is the most difficult part for offensive teams when they actually want to build a zero-day vulnerability and deploy it. Finding a vulnerability is not the thing that's difficult. The thing that's particularly difficult is overcoming all of the anti-exploit mitigations and systems that have been put in place in order to make vulnerabilities really hard to exploit. And that actually, in the event that you want to massively increase the cost to attackers of foreign adversaries using zero-day vulnerabilities, you have a much higher bang for the buck looking for ways to reduce vulnerabilities as a category, or to re-engineer software so that entire categories of vulnerability are not available, or to build exploit mitigations that defend against a much broader category of vulnerability than doing it one by one.
Or, Matt, come on, would you agree with me that if we spent all the money, instead of on the VEP, on someone looking at malvertising, we would be doing
I think
that?
I would agree with that, yeah.
So, and this is what we're looking at here, is all of this effort and money we spent on the VEP, all of it is wasted when you could spend that time actually looking at issues that matter.
So you're...
Like, when I hit Politico, one out of two of those ads is actually trying to
Okay, so your argument, Dave, as I understand it, is basically keep most of the vulnerabilities that you discover and focus your defensive efforts on non-zero-day issues like ransomware, like, the things that are actually hurting you on a day-to-day basis.
I think that's a much better policy decision, and I think we fell into this trap with the VEP because it's sexier. And We didn't have the policy expertise in cyber in our administration to know
better. Now, how much of it is that it's sexier? And how much of it is that the companies are politically powerful and the companies really don't like the idea of the U.S. government hoarding vulnerabilities to their products and not informing them about it?
And that's because they're better at PR. You're 100% right. Those are equal aspects of this. But if they really were smart about it, they'd think, you know what? OODAs are actually what we want the government to do. What we don't want them doing is intercepting our product and messing with our supply chain, because that can kill your entire export market. So that's where they should be focusing, you know, like on, you know, our cryptographics are secure. Our government is not backdooring our stuff. They're not, doing supply chain interdiction. You know, we are a trusted supplier, and we can tell you that when you buy our product, you're getting what we sold you. That's hugely important to all of these vendors. The government finding vulnerabilities in your product, honestly, that's your own fault. If you have a Stack Overflow in 2016, as Cisco is now seeing that they have, as you know, FortiGate is having, and you know, obviously TopSec and the others. That Equation Group release, it's not, you know, it the PR hit that the government's taking is not what they should be focusing on, but yet that's what we see in the news.
So, Matt, talk us through the latest release and the latest set of disclosures and how this interacts with this discussion of the vulnerabilities equities process.
There was recently a disclosure by a group calling themselves the Shadow Brokers of what appears to be an NSA toolkit, which contains a large number of vulnerabilities in things like Cisco firewalls and so on. The zero days are certainly real. This has caused a lot of upset by those vendors who say, you know, in the event that this was the NSA, and I think that there's good reasons to believe it is the NSA, that in the event that the NSA has been hoarding these zero-day vulnerabilities, they have been stolen by someone who is not the NSA. Does that fundamentally change our understanding of zero-day collisions? Because, this is a zero-day vulnerability that not just the NSA had. This is a vulnerability that also the Shadow Brokers group has had for some period of time, and the NSA has not disclosed it. So there is, I think, you know, an interesting discussion to be had about both whether or not zero-day vulnerabilities tend to collide when two groups are independently looking for them, but also whether or not zero days collide when one foreign intelligence group is able to steal the zero days of another foreign intelligence group. Does that change our analysis? And I think that's the type of thing that, you know, the vulnerabilities equities process has not been very good at understanding. It's not been very data-driven in trying to analyze. And I think, you know, we need to sort of have a broader discussion as to whether or not that is the type of collision that we should be more concentrating on, rather than the zero-day collisions caused by, for instance, independent researchers looking for zero days in a particular product.
Okay, so let me use this to push back on the thesis here. Here we have a set of disclosures that, as you say, are not merely being used, zero days that are not merely being used by NSA for whatever offensive purposes they choose, i.e. the sort of strategic benefits of hoarding zero days, but are also, because they're now out in the wild and presumably have been, at least in a limited sense, maybe since 2013, have been available for somebody's use against Cisco and all of Cisco's clients and customers. So why isn't that a good argument, Dave, against your view that that zero days don't pose a particular threat to U.S. architecture and interests, and that this is sort of largely You know, this isn't ransomware. This isn't, you know, ad malware. This is, you know, this is a zero day that somebody's had access to against Cisco for a long time. Why shouldn't we have an instinct to balance the strategic value of having access to it against the strategic negative value of somebody having access to it against us?
Well, I think the first answer to your question is that's not a strategic response. That's a very, very low-level tactical response. The strategic response would be to say, this technology, whatever it is, let's say Cisco routers, is so important to American interests in terms of commerce and security that we cannot stand any weaknesses in it. And then to ask yourself, what do we do to prevent weaknesses? And I guarantee you, the first thing you do is not disclose your vulnerabilities. Your vulnerabilities are, I mean, this is what Project Zero that Google has is for as well. The vulnerabilities are there to give you understanding of the classes of weaknesses you have and also the levels of weaknesses you have. So in this case, if I was to look at the Cisco ASA vulnerability, what it would tell me was that there's a simple Stack Overflow in really long SNMP requests to the Cisco management interface, the SNMP management interface. And that if I want to provide any kind of security on any of my networks, I better say to all of my customers, don't ever run the SNMP interface for management of your own Ciscos, because they clearly have done no hardening of that platform, and they've done no security reviews of that platform. And that's their own problem. I can't solve that problem for them by telling them about one overflow. But I can provide that guidance to every, you know, military installation or even the whole world and say, look, this product is not fit to be used in this way. This configuration is insecure. And this is what you saw IAD doing. They would release hardening guides for Windows. That is a strategic response to the problem of code quality within certain parts of Windows. What you see here is a completely tactical response. Let's fix this one vulnerability, as if there's not six more in the code right next to it. So that's I think the cleanest and best argument against, you know, patching these things is going to make us more secure, because it just doesn't. We know it doesn't for history.
What's your take on that, Matt? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. So in the event that I was reviewing, you know, a piece of code like the Cisco ASA from source code, this type of bug would be really obvious. It would stand out very clearly as a Stack Overflow, or at the very least stand out clearly as, you know, a code that is badly engineered and looks like there would be vulnerabilities in it that would require re-engineering. And in the event that you were, you know, writing a report of the top 10 things that you would want Cisco to do, the, you know, individual bugs are obviously things that you would want them to fix. But the fact that, for instance, in this particular case, Stack Overflows are largely a solved problem in computer security, the fact that Cisco has not deployed basic anti-exploit mechanisms to defend its products against, you know, categories of bugs that were being exploited in 1997. I mean, this is 20-year-old stuff. The fact that Cisco's routers are, you know, vulnerable to these things is really an indictment of the quality of the code rather than something that NSA bears some special responsibility to help them fix. And I think that it's also important to realize that, you know, there is a significant difference between being able to point to a vulnerability and say, this thing needs to be fixed here, versus the amount of engineering work that is required in order to turn that into a fully operational exploit that you can deploy in, you know, your cyber warriors can deploy as sort of a point-and-click exercise inside intelligence agencies. You know, one is something that you can work out in a couple of hours doing a code review, and the other is something that takes months and months of very highly skilled effort. And so the question really, I think, is should the NSA be, you know, taking these incredibly expensive tools because they require such high skill and high cost to develop, you know, and give these to vendors, or should vendors be spending the comparatively actually quite small amounts of money in order to code review their own things and to re-engineer them so that they are secure?
Okay, so I want to try to bring this all together and figure out what it is that you guys are arguing for to replace the vulnerabilities equities process. So in your ideal policy and operational world, when NSA comes upon or discovers or buys a zero day, what sort of review should it go through? How interagency a review, and under what circumstances should it be disclosed to the vendor?
Well, I don't know that you ever need to disclose a vulnerability that is not posing a clear and present danger in the sense that you already also know it is being used by your adversary. So you're really arguing
for a vulnerability equity singular process, as in the single outstanding equity is offensive.
Well, I think it is. The single outstanding equity for particular vulnerabilities is offensive. When you're talking defensive, you're most often talking, how do I improve the security development lifecycle of vendors that I rely on and that I know I'm at risk for compromise of? So in the case of, for example, government systems that run the White House network, if we know for a fact that there's a vulnerability in them that they cannot work around and we need that fixed, then we can fix it. And I don't think it's like about disclosure at that point. It's about working with the vendor. So it's really a very thick touch. It's not a, here's something and I throw it over the fence and I hope you fix it. And I think, people misunderstand how you get things fixed. And that's, for example, the process at Microsoft is if I was to tell Microsoft about a new vulnerability tomorrow, it would go to a very elite team. They would look at it, they'd triage it, they'd say, yes, it's a vulnerability, and they'd put it in their giant database of millions of other vulnerabilities just like it, some of which are marked don't fix because we don't feel like it. And the ones they think they should fix go to a team in India that sometimes fixes them, sometimes doesn't fix them, hard to say. And then it gets released in the next patch. So even in the case when you are working with a vendor to try to fix something, you have very little guarantee that the fix is correct. And so that's why it's almost always better, if you're thinking defensively, to think about things other than vulnerabilities, because those are, those are not the platform that you need to rely on. You need to find a mitigating factor of some kind.
So, Matt, how about you? If you're imagining the ideal government response to a new discovered zero day, what does it look like?
So I think I agree mostly with what Dave's been saying there, that really actually from a defensive perspective, we need to stop thinking about individual zero days, and we need to start thinking about defense sort of from a more holistic, from a higher perspective, and to recognize that the types of things that NSA are interested in are not necessarily the same things that foreign governments are interested in. And actually, NSA has a big sort of counterintelligence, counter-cyber team that is responsible for understanding what foreign adversaries are doing, especially foreign governments, but also to a lower extent things like ransomware and major crime groups, to understand what they're doing and to essentially build defensive programs around that, to say, for instance, in the event that we know there's a particular campaign going on for installing very large quantities of ransomware, can we do specific things against that? In the event that we know that an adversary is primarily targeting a particular version of Adobe Reader and NSA is largely not targeting that, can we help Adobe to build sort of much more broad stroke defensive policies to, rewrite certain components of that so that they're secure, or to build specific exploit mitigation so that that particular adversary is unable to exploit things? And I don't think that necessarily works at the we found or purchased a particular zero-day vulnerability, should we disclose it? That actually we ought to be thinking much more from a how do we protect our networks and our citizens and our businesses from that category of attack that someone else is doing. And that might not look like disclosing vulnerabilities. It might look like investing in research to, you know, defensive research. It might look at trying to incentivize U.S. businesses to invest in security of their products where that matters. And, you know, let the offensive missions of NSA help in the defensive missions by doing things like counter-hacking of, you know, other people's malware servers to understand how they're attacking us.
Which we do. And I think the other place that people forget is that we've also invested a lot in network monitoring. So you can, I mean, part of the equity process, and it's not vulnerability equities. I think that's where we went wrong. It's really cybersecurity equities. Like, we should be helping Einstein 3 detect vulnerabilities, and we should be doing it with our partners. For example, when I go visit Jordan and we're talking to, you know, our partners there, they should be able to deploy Einstein 3 and be protected against the latest Chinese ODEs that we happen to know about. You know, I think there's Peter Zatko's work, which is much more strategic, and it's really about what you shouldn't buy. And lately it's been about, you know, determining ratings. But those ratings can be fed from a lot of different things, and part of it can be from your ODE research, right? So if I know that Huawei, for example, is a particularly buggy router in a way that I think is important that customers should know about, then we can say, look, you're allowed to buy, as a U.S. telecommunication company, anything with a grade of A or B. But when it gets down to C, you're not allowed to buy it and put it on a U.S. government
network. So I want to talk about
the
political valence of this, because everything you guys are saying runs directly contrary to the entire directional momentum of the public conversation. The public conversation, as you guys know, sounds like this. Every time a new vulnerability shows up, and the shadow brokers example is a good example of this. The immediate question is, why, oh, why didn't NSA disclose this vulnerability? It's never, why, oh, why did NSA disclose this vulnerability? It's never, you know, did, you know, should they be keeping more of them? And it's never, you know, are you know, do you give up more in offensive capability than you buy in defense when you disclose something to a company that will patch it in its own good time, if at all? And so my question is, you know, what, how much of what you guys are saying sounds counterintuitive only because the public conversation is very, very different from the internal government conversation? And how much of what you guys are saying is, sounds counterintuitive because it in fact runs counter to the way most people are thinking about this issue at a policy level right now?
Both those things are true. I would say that, you know, at some level, Matt and I are the Lorax, and we speak for the trees. There's a lot of people out there who just are not commenting on this issue and are unable to comment on this issue and maybe have things to do and therefore are too busy to comment on this issue. But any analysis by a technical person, and I mean, Twitter's a terrible forum for this sort of discussion, but, you know, when you see the EFF, who is ostensibly a technical advocacy group, getting beat up on Twitter by every single exploit developer that has ever existed, there's a reason for that, which is that those exploit developers are busy writing exploits. They are not particularly savvy in when it comes to law and necessarily policy. And the policy community is off on a branch here that the technical community is trying to reel them back in from. I agree that it's in Microsoft's best interest. They are a very, very savvy PR team. Cisco has a savvy PR team. Google has a savvy PR team. The NSA does not have a savvy PR team, to put it bluntly. So, you know, not that they're not smart. They just are maybe handcuffed and busy with many things. I honestly, this issue our cyber equities in this government have been confused from the very top. We don't know how to fight this crypto war, or if we should be fighting the crypto war. We don't know how the vulnerability stuff fits in with it. The Wassenaar thing was a disaster through and through and remains a disaster. So, I mean, when it comes to where we're getting policy, that's the larger issue. Our cyber policy team needs to realize they can't learn this stuff in an hour in a meeting at the CFR. You need to actually spend time learning what a bug is, what a bug class is. And I think we've spent all this time talking about vulnerabilities, and no one's mentioned that you can't say that a vulnerability is alive or dead. You can't say that they are sparse or dense. You can't say that they are fixed or unfixed, or, you know, where the boundaries between one vulnerability and another one lies, because a lot of times they fit together like Lego pieces to make an exploit. So all of it's so much more complex than the policy team has even recognized yet. And that's why we're trying to yank them back.
So, Matt, what do you see as the prospect of a reorientation of this policy? Or is this sort of now fixed in the DNA of the way NSC and you know, the sort of policy brass of you know, this and a likely future administration sees it? Or is this something that you really could reorient if you chose to?
Well, I think it's something that we can reorient and something that we probably should, because we're now at this slightly odd position of everybody agrees that the vulnerabilities equities process is broken. You know, we have people from the EFF saying it is broken. We have people from the intelligence community saying it is broken. And in the event that...
But of course, they mean totally different things by this. What EFF means is that sometimes the vulnerabilities equities process doesn't recommend disclosing. And what you guys mean is that mostly it does. That's not describing the same brokenness.
Yeah, and I think that we now have a rare opportunity, now that everybody agrees that it is broken, to actually collect the data on it and then just say, well, you know, one of these sides has to be right. So we can get, you know, the intelligence community can provide data, possibly in classified form, to say, this is the number of zero-day collisions that have actually occurred over, you know, 10 years of collecting data. And in the event that the answer is, you know, most of our zero days are colliding with foreign adversaries, then, you know, the EFF clearly wins. And in the event that the answer is none of our zero days have ever collided, then actually the intelligence community wins. And we need to recognize that, you know, this isn't necessarily the best way of doing defense. And I think, you know, a really good example for this as to, you know, some of the Silicon Valley companies, you know, playing the PR game over this is the Tor network investigative technique, the vulnerability in Tor browser, which was a fork of Firefox's browser, used in the Playpen case. And Mozilla, you know, has filed amicus briefs in some of these cases saying, you know, we're very upset that the government has not been telling us what the zero-day vulnerability used in this Tor exploit was. And, you know, that's one way of approaching that problem. But one thing that they haven't done is they haven't spent any engineering effort at all in building a sandbox for their browser, in, you know, making it harder systemically to exploit the Firefox browser. And I think, you know, people need to ask this type of question. They need to say, you know, is that really the correct approach? Should you be spending all of your money on PR and beating up the NSA and saying, you know, these guys ought to be releasing these zero days? Or should you be spending a bit more, you know, of your cash actually securing your product? The Cisco vulnerabilities, you know, one of those vulnerabilities was a Stack Overflow vulnerability that, you know, we've known how to protect against that category of attack since, you know, 2002-ish. And if they had just enabled default options for building their software, they would have been secure against that vulnerability. Is that the NSA's fault? Is that the, you know, should the NSA be providing these zero days, or should Cisco be building more secure software? What is the correct approach to this? And I don't think that it's necessarily, you know, the federal government's responsibility to, you know, be giving handouts all the time.
And we haven't talked about future-proofing it at all, because, you know, one of the other things that I think came out in our little post is that this idea that we're going to be living in a world of plenty forever when it comes to our intelligence capability is probably wrong. I mean, it's such a pessimistic view to think that, you know, the NSA produces these vulnerabilities and we don't really need them because we have so many. But things are legitimately getting harder. It's getting more and more expensive to create these things. It's getting much more likely that you're going to get caught when you're using them, because I don't know if you've noticed, but, you know, defensive technologies have advanced. So there's going to come a point when you're going to need this massive amount of them, just this big advantage of an understanding in order to get the job done. And that's a really important job. No one talks about how important the job that these things provide is to our security overall.
How far away from that point are we, in your view?
Well, I would say that we are facing very wily adversaries. And if I look at Kaspersky's recent releases, you know, the trend line is up. And it, I don't know if it's exponential, but it's definitely, we're starting to lose O'Day. And I think we haven't really talked about the Equation Group leak, but, you know, that's an example of getting caught. And it's not, you know, it's either getting caught or it's a insider. And it, if we take the case that we got caught, that didn't used to happen. And so, and it definitely didn't get used to leaked by the Russian intelligence. So, you know, we're in a new world here. This is a world that really should lean toward non-disclosure from a strategic level, because we're going to need this stuff. Without it, we can't open the iPhones of terrorists. That's the lesson the FBI learned. And I think they learned it pretty hard. And beyond that, we do need a cyber equities process. I don't think Matt or I are going to say you don't need any kind of understanding of your strategic posture. We just don't think a vulnerabilities equities process is, you know, for the first thing, it's not the most pressing part of your cyber equities. You're not going to make Silicon Valley happy with you by releasing a few vulnerabilities. Historically, it just annoys people. It just makes them feel lame and jealous that you have them in the first place. But we have to decide what we will and won't do as a government from a strategic perspective. It has nothing to do with vulnerabilities, but does need a board, does need an equities process to take place at the top levels of government in the White House. That's completely different from the vulnerabilities, which the NSA should do the fine job they do of taking care of all by themselves.
I want to thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, who has what some might call an unusual approach to social media.
I post my personal cell phone to Twitter so people can call me and yell at me.
And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and email.